Welcome to Crosstalk, coming to you from South Florida. We are the number one podcast in the world, universe. And I'm here today with Allie. Welcome to Crosstalk.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited. I can't wait. So here on Crosstalk, we kind of share our stories and we try to help people in recovery, just find their path and just tell them how we did it kind of thing. So I'd love for you to start with, you know, where are you from? How'd you grow up? Kind of give me a little idea of how your life was like growing up.
Okay. So I grew up in Massachusetts. I frankly had a very good childhood. I don't come with any like crazy, fascinating, traumatic childhood stories. I had two parents, two younger brothers. Their parents are still together. Kind of your classic Boston Irish Catholic giant family, lots of cousins. I was a super active kid, like very involved in everything, you know, type A, good at school, good at sports, good at music, like liked being involved in things, which, you know, as you learn when you get sober, like, yeah, maybe some of those things were sort of part of the budding alcoholic, you know, kind of always wanting to achieve and do well and be a part of. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, as far as drinking was concerned, it was very normalized in my family, in my household. Like I said, you know, big Irish Catholic family, lots of holiday get-togethers, alcohol was always around. But it was very much, the way that I perceived it was that it was something that was fun. And it was a way to, like, you could kind of work hard, play hard, and as long as life was going the way it was supposed to go, like, you were okay. Right. For me and my story, it was, you know, it wasn't until adulthood that things kind of started to be less okay. I didn't even dabble with drinking in high school. Like, I think my junior year, my boyfriend handed me a beer at like a bonfire and I drank three sips of it and gave it back. And was just like,
that's high school?
No, thanks. Yeah.
Wow. My junior year.
My
you were
first.
A late bloomer.
Oh, I really was. My first drunk wasn't until college. I was, and in some ways, and so you asked about like the childhood in the extended family. There was addiction and alcoholism, and I remember my mom. She kind of warned me, like, "Hey, this stuff runs in our family." Like,
oh wow, she
be
did.
Be aware of this. And so I think in some ways I definitely avoided the drugs, because I was just a little bit too much of a Miss Perfect to go near that. And the alcohol was sort of similar, but I also remember in the back of my head, and I use this as an excuse with my classmates, you know, with the peer pressure to like, oh no, it runs in my family, like I'm just not even gonna go near it. I think there was maybe more truth to that than I realized at the time. At the time, it kind of just felt like an excuse to like get them off my back. But there was. And so I did kind of have that awareness. And I, you know, even when I got to college and started drinking more in, so I played soccer in college and I was a chemical engineering student. So I was super busy all the time. And so that work hard, play hard kind of mentality absolutely applied. And, you know, the one night a week that we would be allowed by team rules to go out and drink, it was very normal. And all of my peers got trashed. Like the idea of casual drinking in college was definitely not a thing. I mean, I think a lot of people experience that when they go to college.
Definitely.
But yeah, I kind of recognized even then, though, that like I could handle more than my peers, and like I would often be the one to kind of make sure my teammates got home safely, and then it wasn't until junior senior year in college where I started noticing, like, not only was I different in drinking when it came to drinking than them, in how much I could handle and how it affected me, which was like, you know, some of them they'd have three shots and be like falling down. I'm like, perfectly fine. Right. You know, we're like, which at the time I was proud of, like, you know, I was like, yeah, exactly. At the time I was like, oh, like I can handle my alcohol. Like, oh, I'm God, so tough, too. You know? And now I'm like, oh, that's once again, kind of the hindsight being 2020.
Right. Exactly. I thought that it was like a good thing too. Right. I was like, I could drink you down under the table.
Right. Right. Like, so cool.
So attractive.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, so it kind of evolved from there.
Was there anything that happened junior year that maybe like made you drink more, or did you just become more aware that like, okay, it's affecting me differently? Did you like it? Did you black out? Like what?
Yeah. So blacking out was like a pretty normal occurrence.
Okay.
And it was, and again, to the point of like, I didn't think anything of it, was that many of my peers also blacked out drinking at the college I went to. And, like part of the fun of the weekend was like getting together the next morning and putting the pieces of the night back together, you know? And,
God, I remember that.
And, right. sitting at the,
brunch.
At the, yeah, exactly. At the
with
dining
more
hall
alcohol.
Brunch. Yeah. Yeah. And then, right. And then you get to the restaurant brunches later. Yeah. But there was, so I remember my sophomore year, I was always a really bad sleeper. It's like still to this day, it's something that I like have to, kind of manage. But I took a, I remember, I had a game the next day. I think I had like a lab and an exam, like, so like, and it was 2 a.m. and I had to be up at 7 and I couldn't sleep. Like my anxiety, my nerves, like I was so restless, could not sleep. And I waited until my roommate, I could tell she was like out cold, like fast asleep. Mm-hmm. And I went to the, you know, the handle of $12 vodka that was hidden in our sophomore dorm room, and took a shot. And went to sleep. And I remember like it, that wasn't like the beginning of, oh, and I was drunk for the rest of my life. But I remember like noting that, like, this worked. This thing just solved my problem. And it wasn't in a social setting. It wasn't with friends. It wasn't for fun. It wasn't partying. It was like as medicine. Like it was to knock myself out, mm-hmm. to quiet those voices in my head that were making me crazy. Mm-hmm. And of course, that time one shot did it. Over time, as we know, one shot no longer does the trick.
Right, right.
But yeah, so that was my sophomore year in college. So I went from not drinking at all in high school to like playing around with it freshman year to sophomore, like within 2 years, like noticing like this is medicine. This isn't just something that's fun.
Right. Well, they say it's a number. Well, it is progressive, number one, but also it's funny because as a part of the program that I'm a part of, which is a 12-step program, in the literature, it says like, to women, it happens faster, which I don't know if that's because it was written in like the 1930s or right. if it's because it's true.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was a progressive, like progressive for me, but it like, I went down pretty fast when I went down.
Yeah.
Like, oops.
Yeah. So I managed to.
That's fine. Don't worry about that.
Managed.
5 second rule.
The life is messy.
5 second rule.
Yeah, so I can definitely like, relate to that, right? Like, and it still, it took a little in college that you asked if there was anything that kind of triggered it. And I did have my senior year was when soccer was over. And I kind of like also even school got slightly easier. I had a job offer, so I was done with recruiting. So senior year in college, kind of a lot of the pressures and other areas that I could kind of hyper-focus on, and they weren't as intense, and mostly I didn't have the soccer. And at the end of my senior season, I got a really bad concussion on the field playing soccer, and lied about my symptoms to get back on. It was my senior year. Like, you're going to tell a Division I athlete that they can't play their last game of their senior year? Like, absolutely not.
Right.
And at the time, it was kind of just the beginning of when concussion protocol started to be something that, you know, trainers focused on and that coaches cared about. I think my sophomore year was the first year that we even had concussion protocol. So they had this 3-day rule. I knew what the rule was. I knew what I had to say to get myself back on the field. So I just lied about my symptoms and got back on the field. And as one of the first plays back out there, went up for a ball in the air, landed on the ground, whiplash, hit my head on the ground again. And when you already have a concussion, a second concussion is like way easier to get. And so that was, you know, one of the last games of the season. And
could that cause like lasting?
Yeah.
Really?
So actually concussion and like head trauma is kind of a significant part of my story too.
Okay.
Because while I definitely had a lot of the alcoholism tendencies, and I know that I was on a path to need to stop at some point in my life, it was rapidly escalated by concussion. Yeah. And so it happened my senior year in college. At the time, I didn't really, I mean, when you're the one experiencing the symptoms, right? Like it's hard to identify them in the moment, but looking back, I mean, I retreated from all of my friends and teammates. I started drinking alone during the day in my room at, you know, 21 years old, hiding it. Like, I don't know, maybe some people noticed, but I did what I could to make sure that it, you know, wasn't. And because I was so good at, you know,
hiding,
yeah. And I could hold so much liquor that, like, you know, I have a couple drinks with them. They think maybe I've had a couple more than them, but not that I've drank, you know, a double bottle of wine alone in my room over the course of the afternoon before joining all my friends at the bar.
Right.
Which is what was happening. And
you're how old at this point?
22.
Okay. 22. So is this end of senior year?
This was, the spring semester senior year.
Okay.
And so a lot of those kind of post-concussion symptoms are, they're, you know, heightened anxiety, depression, inability to concentrate, a lot of things that just like make generally functioning as an adult challenging. Yeah, so I guess senior year, and I had already had some concussions from soccer, actually, yeah, no alcohol-related ones, just some concussions from growing up and playing soccer. And so these kind of back-to-back ones, senior year at the end of my season, kind of led right into spring of senior year, where there were fewer responsibilities, I had less work on my plate, and heightened mental health symptoms, right. Depression, anxiety, lack of focus. And the way that, you know, maybe a non-alcoholic would handle that is by seeking some sort of support or help or, you know, medical attention. The way that this alcoholic handled it was by drinking alone in her room. And so I managed to, you know, I was still on the younger side, still pretty high functioning. And so managed to kind of pull myself out of that. And I, you know, my brain probably healed a bit from the concussions. And I moved from being in school in Pennsylvania to start my first job as a chemical engineer out in Kansas.
Very smart.
Which, well, is sometimes, sometimes. it's hard.
I find that so interesting, though, chemical engineering. chemistry was my favorite course.
Was it really?
Yeah, actually.
No way.
I'm good at math, so I think
cool.
I was okay at chemistry.
Yeah.
But I find it really interesting. And, you know, anyway, take it away, because I just want to hear more about your job and like what you were doing.
So the job part was boring. especially so I was... I had interned for this company, gotten an offer. So I got a random assignment. So it was a rotational program, which was wonderful because it moved me around the country. I got to experience so many things that I am so grateful for, that shaped me as a person, you know, experiences for my career that were and are invaluable. But yeah, so my first assignment, they took this Boston girl who went to college in Pennsylvania, never left the Northeast, and, you know, stuck me out in Kansas for a year. And I was, you know, still coming off of being super depressed, relying on alcohol as my, you know, coping, and was out kind of in what for me was the middle of nowhere, and didn't know anyone, had no family, no friends out there. So that was kind of a tough year, and made some friends, made the most of it, had a great experience, you know, working out in Kansas. The people were fantastic. And I, you know, got to work in an actual chemical plant, which was really cool. Like you go from the classroom where you see it, you know, on paper, and to actually get to experience it in real life was awesome. But yeah, it was kind of a very depressed year for me. And I moved back, but was still keeping it together, you know? But I still, it's so funny. It's funny the things that come up when they come up, because I haven't remembered this in a while. I haven't thought about Kansas in a long time. But my boss, when I was in Kansas, I shared an office with him, and I used to come in every day hungover as hell. Like I must have smelled like alcohol. Like right. I was drinking myself to sleep every night. Like I remember.
Did you have friends there? You said not really.
Not really.
No.
I had a couple of coworkers, and we kind of became friends out of necessity. Right. I'm still in touch with one of them, but yeah, even that, just because of social media, right? And so we were definitely each other's, you know, people when we were out there, which was wonderful. Like we needed each other. At least I needed them.
I'm sure.
And there were, you know, the people who lived out there were so welcoming to us. Like they invited us to all their family gatherings. You know, we did pumpkin carving with their families. We went to the 4th of July cookout, and they lit fireworks in the backyard. Like, so we were very much taken care of. And I was also still super homesick, lonely, and going through a pretty bad bout of depression and budding alcoholism. But so that boss sat me down one day, because I had been coming in late, and you know, would disappear to go take a nap on the floor of the bathroom, because there was only two other women that worked in the whole place, so there was never anyone in the showers in like the plant bathroom.
Did your boss ever catch you?
Not the sleeping part that I'm aware of, but he did become aware of the fact that I was showing up late every day. I was taking long lunches because I was sleeping it off in my car at lunch. And I was also just miserable at work. I didn't want to be there. I was asking, you know, a whole other host of reasons, like that I wasn't super happy in that job. But one day after, so my boss had a sit down talk with me, kind of a like, he had been working for years and had kind of a, this is how it's done kid kind of a talk with me. Mm-hmm. It was like, we show up at 8 o'clock and we take an hour lunch, like kind of none of this bending the rules kind of stuff. Like, let's be consistent here. And so after having that conversation, I showed up on time to work early, even. For the first time in months.
Right, right. Making up for lost time.
Yeah, exactly. After, you know, the tear-filled conversation about how, like, I'm trying my best, you know, like, I'll
right,
be better.
Right, right. You're trying my best.
Oh. Yeah. And when I got there, though, and I didn't pay attention enough to know that he was sober. But looking back, he never came to any of the company events, kind of poo-pooed going to the happy hours and the, you know, the functions where people were drinking. And I remembered someone saying, oh yeah, he doesn't drink. And that morning that I showed up early, he had something up on his computer, and it was a 12-step program, like flyer email.
Just happened to have it on his computer for mm-hmm. you to see it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so obviously at that point in my life, I was just like, oh, what a weirdo, you know?
Right. Like, who doesn't like, drink?
What a loser who doesn't drink. Like, you know what I mean?
Oh my God, like, I know.
But it's one of those things, like you look back and it's like, there's a God shot for you, you know? Like that my boss at that time in my life happened to be someone who was in a position to help me if I wanted to get sober, you
right.
know? And I just wasn't ready yet. My journey was not for me to get sober that year. And from then on, you know, the following years after that, I continued to drink daily. I continued to binge drink. But I was always able to kind of like show up and do well at work. And from that job on, I was in positions that I liked, and I liked what I was doing. And I was kind of more fulfilled in my life and kind of therefore able to manage the balance a little bit better.
So you were high functioning.
And I was high functioning. And I think being young, I was physically capable also. And my brain had kind of, you know, hadn't gotten to the point where the anxiety was so overwhelming yet. But I say yet in part because I also moved every year over the course of 5 years. The first five years of my career.
That's and, a lot. Oh yeah. My God.
And not like across the city. Like I moved across the country. So I moved from Pennsylvania to Kansas, back to Pennsylvania, to New Orleans, Louisiana, and then to Austin, Texas, and then to Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay.
I did a year in each of those places. Mm-hmm. And so each of those times too, like when it would start to catch up to me, like when the drinking would start to catch up, when the anxiety would start to catch up, when kind of some of the ramifications of being hungover every day, or, you know, I was on my way out.
Right.
You know, like I was kind of already on to the next thing, and I was supposed to be. I was a part of a rotational program where you're expected to, you know, stay in the
Move
role.
On.
Like around 6 months, you start thinking about the next thing. Around 8 months, you start interviewing for the next thing. And so the standards for you as an employee aren't necessarily that, like, you're going to stay in that spot and continue to grow and get better. It's that, okay, yeah, they're on to the next thing. So when, you know, my focus or attention wasn't maybe as high as it should have been, it was easily explained away. And then I would move to a new place where I'd have the luster of a new city and mm-hmm. new friends and new a new role that, you know, had my interest again. I wasn't bored of it. And so like the cycle would kind of repeat. And right. so I was able to stay in that high functioning pattern for a long time. And I also wasn't around people who knew me really well.
So you got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I wasn't, my mother, my dad, my father, my brothers, my cousins, friends who had known me my whole life, who knew me before I started drinking, they weren't around to kind of notice maybe some of these changes that might've been red flags. And when they were, and when I saw them, you know, it's like you can put on a face for as long as you want, or, you know, for a short period of time.
Yeah. Sorry.
So I was able to kind of to make it work. And
I mean, no one's holding you accountable.
Yeah. And I was doing well at work, you know, and people liked me, and I was able to kind of get by on my, you know, whatever resume or personality or whatever, you know, us addicts are charming, right?
I know.
Like, we managed to get away with a lot of stuff
yeah.
for a long time, right? Like, and so, so I feel like I kind of had some of that. And then, when I was living in Austin, decided I needed a change, that my mental health was really bad. I was drinking a lot, but that wasn't the problem.
It was Austin,
right? I just had some anxiety problems. I needed to be, you know, I needed to move again. Like the, mm-hmm. the job I was in was the issue. So I started looking for new jobs, and I applied to business school, and I decided that, you know, school really burned me out the first time, but if I got into, I only applied to three schools, and if I got into one of the three schools, then I would go. If not, I'll just try and get another job. And I wound up getting into Harvard Business School.
Harvard Business School. And that's a big deal.
Yeah, it
you were doing something
like
right. I
mean, yeah, right. That's the thing. You're like,
so hard.
Right. And so it was. At
You're
the
crumbling,
time,
but
crumbling inside. Yeah. Right. And again, like looking back at it, it's I was searching for something this whole time. Every move, every job change, every time that I upended my life, like I was trying to fill something inside that was empty.
Yeah.
And I was dying inside, and I didn't know. Like, I remember that job in Austin. I remember Googling, like, what does it mean if I wish that I don't wake up in the morning? Like I was like trying to understand what passive suicidal thoughts were, and that was just normal. Like in my mind, it was like, oh, everyone must feel this way. I didn't know that no one else felt, or, you know, not
yeah.
many people felt that way, that wasn't a normal thing to be Googling at work is like, why don't I want to wake up in the morning?
Right.
And So when I got into Harvard, I was like, this is going to solve all my problems. I just got into my dream school. I'm moving back home to Boston. I'm going to be able to like restart my life. Like this is, I'm not going to be an engineer anymore. I'm bored of engineering. I want to be more on the people side of things. That'll solve the problem. In my mind, this was like the ultimate solution. I get to travel. Like I, you know, took off from work a couple months before starting school. And so I, you know, used that opportunity and the excitement of all of that like kind of helped temper the drinking back. And so, like that's for a long time, every time it would get bad, like I would change something. I would, you know, fix some of the external things and it would temporarily solve the problem.
Yeah.
And then the real problem would come
back.
So
you're skating bottom, like you're not like getting to your bottom yet.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like progressively getting to a worse bottom each time. Would that be right?
It's like the pendulum that like every time it just gets closer and closer.
It's like the stock market goes, oh. No, I have similar situations. I did a lot of moving around and it was not me. It was like London was the problem.
Exactly. It was always like everything else.
Greece
that was
the problem. Yeah. Like all these places were the problem.
Right.
It, you know, and I can relate so much to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went to Harvard, which was supposed to solve all my problems.
What happened?
It did not.
How did that work out?
Was
it a great experience? I mean,
you
graduated.
I did not.
Oh,
no.
You did not. Oh,
no. So I drank my way out of Harvard.
Okay.
So one of the most incredible opportunities anyone could ever have, and I drank it away.
I'm sure if you applied again, you'd probably get in again. You'd be able to finish it.
There are avenues. I've chosen not to.
Yeah, I would not either.
Well,
I'm trying to work smarter, not harder these days.
That's
I'm good.
I've done a full like cost benefit analysis of going back. Like it is not it.
Nope, not it. I know too many millionaires without degrees. I'm with you.
Even just the mental health part of it. Like, so when I was there, part of the drinking myself out.
I think that's actually so important to hear. Like, you know, sometimes like there's a great opportunity like going to Harvard, but like the mental health side of it might not be good for you. Like, don't go, right? Like, don't do it. It's not worth it.
I remember saying to my therapist, it was so when I failed out, it was the I failed out because I did. But I was at the beginning of my
you weren't in a good place.
In the beginning of my second semester, I got a nasty concussion. So I was on the school ski trip out in Colorado. I'm a terrible skier. It was my second time ever on skis. My left knee starting to go on me, just overuse and age. And wiped out going, I don't know how fast, face planted. I was wearing a helmet, but face planted. So I don't know.
Helmet
didn't do much. But I blacked out. Don't remember anything. Had to get taken off the mountain in a sled. And to the point, like I remember vaguely getting to the on-site, you know, medical area and them saying, all right, we'll just observe you for 20 minutes and then you can go. They kept me for 4 hours and wouldn't let me leave until someone came and got me because I was like so out of it. And instead, again, very similar to senior year in undergrad, instead of taking a medical leave or like getting some type of actual help, I hid in my dorm room and drank. And I don't think I drew a sober breath for the rest of that year. I showed up to class. When I showed up, I was drunk, to the point where at the end of the semester, I got called in by the student services person who I had actually, right before the accident, made an appointment with him because I was drinking too much and I was I remember recognizing it.
Right.
And saying, like, I think I'm going to talk to a therapist on campus about my anxiety, about my drinking. Like, maybe it's time to do something about this. Literally 1 week later, after having that initial talk with him, I had the skiing accident. Blew off every appointment I had after that. Like I said, at that point, I went from heavy drinker, like you know, the big book says in the 12-step program I work, like the heavy drinker to like full-blown alcoholic.
Yeah.
Like for me, it felt like it happened overnight in that instant. That same student services person reached out to me right before finals and said, hey, can you please come in to meet with me? We need to talk. And of course, like, yeah, exactly. And so I walk in and he said, one of your classmates has reported you because you smell like alcohol all the time.
Oh my God, what a narc.
Right? Honestly, my first thought, right? I'm like, what fucking asshole did this? Like, let me find them, you know? But I
still
also
feel that way. I'm sorry.
But I also, though, like, even in that moment, though, Irene, like, I recognize that it was a kindness. And like I don't know if they did it out of spite, but like I also I was on pretty good terms with most of these people, and that whoever did it because they cared.
Oh no, I'm joking.
Right. And so that's just where our minds go, right? It's like, oh my God.
I mean, it will always go there because I'm a New Yorker and you just don't do that. But at the same time, now I do.
Yeah.
You know, if I see a friend going down, I don't care. Don't talk to me.
Right.
We don't need to be friends.
Right.
But if I see you going down, I'm going to help you.
Right.
You know, and I'm going to, because none of my friends want to do it for me. They were all so scared. And mm-hmm. it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I cry now when I see them and I'm like, I'm so grateful to you. So I don't know if you know who that was or not, like it's your angel.
Yeah.
You
to
know?
This day, no idea.
It's your angel.
So
it's your narc angel.
And the sad happy thing was it was a little too late, you know, right before finals. I'd already missed half the classes. At HBS, literally 50% of your grade is class participation. If you miss more than like two classes, you're like basically automatically
in
the bottom 10%.
Anyway.
I was already toast. I was already toast. But I was also not in a place where like going back for my second year would have been a healthy thing for me. So ultimately it launched me onto a path of trying to get better. It still was not the alcohol's fault, though, Irene.
Oh.
It was the concussion's fault.
Oh,
so
of course.
I spent another
of
5 years blaming the concussion and the mental health and not the alcohol before I actually got sober. So I went from failing out of Harvard to then, you know, moving in with my parents, trying to get back on track, you know, got a job in my field. But yeah, so I still, after failing out of Harvard, I still had a ways to go. A handful of false starts as far as like getting back in my career and trying to get healthy again. But still, like I said, I was completely unwilling to concede that alcohol was the problem. Losing that part of myself felt like a full identity crisis. Like, it wasn't even like an option in my mind that would be it. Like, I had to get myself better so that I could drink like a normal person. Like the dream of every alcoholic that's, you know, failing to get sober. And after struggling for a while, I was back living with my parents and wasn't supposed to be drinking under their roof. I totally, you know, took advantage of their love for me.
I mean, at that point, it's not you taking advantage. I mean, right?
Yeah.
You're sick. You're
right
in it,
right,
as we say.
True.
There's no like come. It's not like I'm trying to hurt you. It's really like I'm in hell.
Yeah. So I was living at their house, waitressing at the Applebee's in a suburban town in Massachusetts. Drunk on the job every day, like packing nips in my, you know, like belt
thing.
With the notepad. And
to the point where you're really all day,
round the clock, all day drunk. Like I said, working, you know, minimum wage job.
You're packing nips in your waitress thing. You're at Applebee's.
Yeah, so I'm waitressing at Applebee's or, you know, waitressing at a kind of chain restaurant.
I think Applebee's
drunk
is
all
still
the time.
Gonna do
we
well.
Can still,
whether
Applebee's.
Even though we are the best podcast in the world, I'm sure Applebee's will do fine either way.
Working in Applebee's, I got promoted from drunk waitress to drunk bartender.
Oh,
talk about high functioning.
Yeah.
So
many things I can say. Isn't the bartender supposed to be drunk?
You know, especially at Applebee's.
Yeah.
So I had been doing that for a couple of weeks and escalated to the point where I had blacked out on a shift. Don't remember leaving. Hopefully the till was right. And I, that night, got a DUI in the parking lot between the liquor store and the Applebee's. I had passed out with like a bunch of empty nips in the passenger seat, parked in that lot after having backed into a retaining wall, and I don't know what all happened, but yeah, I got arrested that night.
So many DUIs with parked cars. Like until I got into recovery, I've never heard about so many DUIs in parked cars. It's like, I guess if the engine is on, that is a ridiculous rule.
Right? I mean, they also had me on camera.
Wait,
I think,
am I a recovery advocate or what? No, but I mean, listen, we can laugh about it, but it's like, that's scary. That's scary, you know.
And I remember the, like, getting, you know, the officer asking me, you know, I came to with the officer knocking on my window and him walking me around to the other side of the car, and I literally couldn't stand. Like, I physically couldn't function.
Move, right.
And I remember him asking me to walk a line, and I was holding myself up on the car, and I don't... You know, the adrenaline kicks in and like you get, when the blackout, like you're still blackout, but you remember the things
because
of the like adrenaline of it all. And I remember saying to him, like, I can't even stand. And like just freaking like take me in already. Like you're going to make me do this dog and pony show. Like I'm obviously fucking wasted. like let's save the whole act and like just get it done.
Let's do this. I've got somewhere to be.
Awful. So yeah, I mean, I blew some ridiculous number, and like, I'm lucky I, you know, wasn't alcohol poison the whole deal. But
I blamed my shoes when that happened to me. I was like, and we were on a hill. I was like, it's the hill.
So that was the second time I've been arrested for DUI. My first one was when I lived in Kansas,
and
I even
hill?
Forgot about it because it was so. I was like, I kind of just got away with it.
Right.
That's the other part of my story is that like because of you know where
who
I came from and what I look like, it like it.
Yeah.
People just kind of like give you a pass.
It's true.
You know,
and it's a
privilege that I try to like recognize and be grateful for because I know it doesn't apply to everyone.
I think that it's been a good and bad, right?
Yeah,
because
and it's
we
enabling.
Didn't have consequence.
There was
right?
no consequence. Yeah, like I said, I didn't even remember the first one because, but until you said the shoe thing, because I also blamed it on my shoes.
They
like,
took me
it's the
in.
Heels. That's why I'm not walking
straight. They took
straight.
Me in, and then they were like, "Can you just have someone come pick you up?"
Yeah.
And I was like, "Okay."
That's basically what happened with my first.
Yeah.
One.
I was like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah.
I was like, "Why'd you impound my car?"
If you were just gonna
and
let
I
me
had,
go,
I was in catering, so like when I went to pick up my car the next day, and I tried to hide it from my parents. Oh my god, it was such a production. I forwarded my mail. Didn't know that when I forwarded my mail, the whole house mail gets forwarded.
Oh,
so my dad
no.
was like, "Where's my mail?"
Oh my god.
And then only my court notices would come, and I was like, "What is happening? This is a nightmare."
The things we try to do. Oh
but I was catering, and when I went to pick up my car the next day, it smelled like food because all the, you know, leftovers that I was, you know, going to bring home to give to someone or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
What a mess. Yeah. Don't get a DUI while you're catering.
Maybe ever.
Yeah. I didn't get a DUI. I got a pass.
Yeah, we got
but,
a
like,
pass.
Don't get in trouble
while
you have food in your car.
Exactly. And yeah, and I even say like that one, I got like a real easy pass. I don't have a criminal record. Like there's,
me too.
The, you know, first Massachusetts, first DUI, like it disappears as long as you keep your nose clean, you know, after that. And you know, thank God I got sober and it didn't continue to be a problem. But, but that DUI wasn't when I got sober. I like that was the first time I went to rehab. And I remember my mom sitting on the bed at my bed, the bed I was sleeping in the next morning after they had gotten me out of, you know, picked me up from jail.
Right.
They had driven 3 hours back from their weekend vacation to bail their daughter out of jail.
They were thrilled.
Said, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She sat on my bed and said, do you think it's maybe time to try rehab? And at that point, I was like, I don't really think I could say no. Yeah.
No.
So
on my way,
begrudgingly went. And she had tried also, before this happened, she had tried to take me to an AA meeting.
Okay.
So I was drunk as a skunk, went to an AA meeting with my mom. And this is another God shot. A woman I grew up with, was in the meeting.
Okay.
And like our parents had, we'd grown up playing soccer together. So like our parents knew each other. And so my mom, you know, sober, walked in with me drunk to this meeting, and we see this woman in here, and she was like, oh my God. And she's, as far as I believe, she's still sober to this day. She was sober then.
Right. How long ago was this?
That would have been 2016, probably. 2017.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is when I went to rehab.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that, like, it took me, yeah.
A couple years longer, right?
Did you go during COVID?
No, it wasn't 2016, because I was in grad school in 2016. So this would have been like 2018, probably.
Okay.
2019. It was pre-COVID. I was in my treatment in down here, though, was during COVID.
Where I met you.
Yes. Yeah. So we
Which
met during
we,
COVID.
We
yeah.
talk about a lot on this podcast.
Really?
They get a lot of press.
Nice.
Yeah. They're a good place,
well,
so it's okay.
I was going to say, they helped me a lot.
Yeah,
so
they saved my life.
I went to 3 other rehabs before that one.
Wow.
And they were all, yeah. So I went to that first rehab, was going to learn how to manage my drinking. And that was my goal for going to rehab, was mm-hmm. to then like get it together, show everyone in my life, like how I could control my drinking, and then it would be cool. And I'd be able to drink with my family again. And, cause that was a huge fear of mine, was like, drinking was a huge part of my family's culture.
Right.
It still is.
Yeah.
Like everyone drinks. And I was terrified that if I didn't drink, that I would lose the most important thing to me in my life, which was my family.
Right.
Which is not true at all.
I
in
know.
My case,
I
right?
know.
Like,
I know.
They are so supportive. And
of
it
course.
Is, like, and I, they're still very much part of my life. I am back to feeling like myself again, rather than being, you know, a drunken asshole
yeah.
at family parties. Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, that was a very real fear of mine. And so yeah, I went to my first rehab, left with a boyfriend 20 years older than me. We were drunk within 2 weeks and ended horribly. Wound up back in rehab again. Stayed sober for like 3 months, but was dry. I tried to work a program. I had started working with a sponsor, but I got to the fourth step and I said,
yeah.
Do I really need to do this?
Right.
And wound up picking up a drink again. And after 2.5 months of sobriety, went on like a 2-week round the clock bender that ended in me trying to kill myself.
Ugh.
And I,
which I'm a huge advocate for suicide prevention.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
been a lot of people in my life have taken their lives, and it's
yeah.
just, I'm glad you're still here.
Me too.
Yeah.
I have a lot of gratitude for the fact that I did not succeed that night, and for the people who helped me that night, my brother being one of them. It was during COVID, so no one, I was in the ICU for a day or two.
Oh, God.
It's weird, like kind of going back to that moment. I'm like, I feel a little like hesitation and not hesitation in talking about it, but it just, I feel reflective,
right?
Like kind of somber. But so I went to, you know, a psych ward after that, and then to a rehab for 6 weeks. And I wish I could say that was, you know, the beginning, but it wasn't.
Right.
I drank again. Like after all of that, I really believed that there was no solution. Like I was told that there was a solution, you know, I was
right.
told that
well,
there,
I mean,
you can work these 12 steps and it'll save your life. And I was like, I mean, I tried that. Like I worked the first three, like
right,
it worked.
Right.
Like if you don't work them, then what is it? Then they don't work, you
right.
know, like what do you
oh.
mean, you know?
Like, right.
And so, So I just, I couldn't see a future where I could exist without alcohol, and I couldn't see a future where existing with alcohol was possible.
Right.
So I got out of a 6-week rehab and waited. My mom got me settled into my apartment. I had a digital kind of aftercare program, like, because it was COVID.
Oh, yeah.
So
I can't
it was just
imagine
me.
Getting sober during COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, it was hard to stay sober during COVID.
That was my experience.
mine too. Yeah, I mean, I checked into.
Yeah. Oh, you're saying for
sober.
You to stay through. Yeah.
I sober checked into rehab. Like, yeah. I was sober, but I felt like I was going insane.
Yeah.
You know, and I thank Makes God sense. They helped me so much. Mm-hmm. But I was like, what is this Twilight Zone like rehab experience where?
Yeah.
I am like kind of stuck in my room.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is going on?
Yeah. It was wild. Crazy times. But so my parents, she got me settled into my apartment, and I waited till, you know, the lights from her car had been out of sight for 5 minutes. And I ran to my car and went to the liquor store and was drunk for the next 3 days until my parents, who now are kind of on high alert, they're like, they almost just lost their daughter. So they were paying pretty close attention.
Yeah.
And they showed up at my door and threatened to have me sectioned, which Massachusetts is like the same as Baker Act kind of thing.
Right. Which means like committed for 3 days to a psych ward.
Yeah. Yeah. So they basically threatened to like have the cops come. And put me away.
Yeah.
For my own safety.
Right. Right. Of course.
And
for real, for your own safety.
Yeah. And I like vaguely, and I didn't really remember this till my dad said it, told me, but he was like, yeah, no, like you wouldn't come with us until like you heard the other person on the other line. Like I actually called like the police to have them come. And it wasn't until you heard them on the other line and you were like, oh no, I'd rather go with you.
Right, right.
And so I went with my parents and they talked to some family friends about like, what do we do? And a place in Florida that was more of a long-term solution came up and... Yeah, I wound up in Florida, and I remember saying to my mom, I had, you know, had some money in my 401k from, like, I was a pretty responsible for all of my alcoholism. I was pretty responsible with my money, and so I had done the retirement programs at work and not touched it. So I had a little bit saved, and I remember saying like, "Mom, that place is too expensive. I can't go there. Like, no, like let's find somewhere that I can use my insurance." She's like, "We've tried that. Like, it's not working.
Right.
Like, let's go." I'm like, we can't. She's like, you do have the money. I was like, but that money's for retirement. And she just looks at me and she
you
goes,
won't be able to retire.
Yeah. Like, what are you talking about, kid? You know, like, and for whatever however she said it, whatever I was feeling in that moment, it registered. And like, I had like a little bit of surrender and said, but it won't work. Nothing works. Nothing else has worked. Why do this? Why waste the money? And I think I said to her, like, I'll just go spend it on a hotel room and get drunk, like, with that money then. Like, I'll just go disappear. Like, I basically threatened to just go disappear in the woods and die. And she looked at me and she was like, you won't last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I knew she was right. And she said, let's try it. If it doesn't work, then we'll see what happens then. But right. Let's just try it. And I said, okay. So we flew down to Florida and
makes me so happy that you tried it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And then life started to get better little by little. Yeah.
I remember meeting you. You were not too happy. And I was in that same spot when I was in there. So I can relate. But it's so funny how when we're in there, you know, it's tough. It's tough to be in a long-term treatment center. You know, you're just like, you hate it. Then there's like some hope. And then you're like, oh, okay. Now get me out of here. You know, it's like this like roller coaster of emotion. But
and so, you're like in the thick of those emotions all day, every day. Oh, you know, like talking about it and with other people who were also going through their own version of that same shit.
Right.
It's a lot.
It's heavy,
and it's saved my life. You know, like I'm so grateful for it. Like I didn't have that type of like deep therapy experience in other places I'd gone. I needed that.
Yeah.
And I needed the longer term kind of care and timeline. It helped me a ton.
I know it's sad that and you know, I don't want to, obviously we're not going to get into an insurance conversation, but it's really sad that insurance doesn't cover long-term care. I'm really angry about it. I mean, it's ridiculous that it's been proven and researched and all of that. And yet insurance companies decide not to cover long-term care is infuriating and frustrating. You know, especially watching people die by the thousands, you know?
Yeah.
So now tell me on another note, because we will not solve the insurance problem today.
Not today.
So tell me what life is. So tell me what early sobriety looks like, actually. Like, you know, I like to ask people, what did early sobriety look like? And then what does it look like today? Because I do find that like what we do our first year is different to what we're doing like right now.
Very different for
me. Yeah.
My early sobriety story is a borderline like still an addiction story.
Well, I think.
I took a little bit of time to actually get to
you
a place
behaviorally?
Where I felt behaviorally.
But I think that's so normal. Yeah. I mean, I think that almost everyone, a lot of people come on this podcast and talk about how in early sobriety they did behaviors that they would not recommend to other people in early sobriety. But I think that's part of like the growing pains.
Right. Absolutely.
So this isn't the first time that people talk about how like behaviors in early sobriety are maybe not so healthy.
Yeah.
So we don't have to go into like too many. What were the healthy things that you feel like helped you in early sobriety?
Absolutely. So my first kind of year of sobriety was I was kind of mostly institutionalized. You know, I spent 4 months in lockdown during COVID in a full-time treatment center. And then the following 6 or 7 in a sober house, which was a hugely helpful to me, being in a sober house environment, having that structure and accountability was A+. And I also, one of the, you know, not so recommended things was that I left rehab with a boyfriend. And so the sober house also helped with boundaries with that, you know, that like I was forced to kind of have my own space from that relationship in those early days, which I'm grateful for.
I was kicked out of that rehab, by the way, and now I'm on the board of advisors. So, you know, you never know where life will take you, but sometimes they do it purposely. Mm. I think halfway sober house, best thing that ever happened.
Yeah.
I fought it.
Yeah.
And I have to say, like, you deal with some dirty people.
It's a whole part of the experience.
It's part of the experience. But, you know, I think that having that accountability in those first few months, people think they don't need it or people scoff at it. And I just think that it's so necessary.
Yeah. I mean, I had, you know, I mentioned I every other rehab I'd gone to, I got out and I went back to my apartment, and, like the scene of the crime, you know, like all those memories, all of that independence. I lived alone, you know, so for me, I actually didn't fight the sober house suggestion. I was like, all right, fine. I was beaten pretty far into a state of submission at that point. Still not fully, because I still wasn't taking all suggestions. You know, I still got the boyfriend. I still didn't get a sponsor, you know, right away. Or I did, but then I bailed on her, you know,
right.
And it didn't actually work my steps. And it wasn't for me until I was a year sober, was still, had just come out of that relationship and was in a really dark place. It you know, as one would expect, it didn't exactly end with sunshine and roses. And I, all of those same feelings that I had when I was, you know, 2 days sober, all came back. All those suicidal feelings,
that
darkness, that like, why am I here? What is the point? Like I felt like it was my first day sober again. And, I luckily, to your question about like what things did I do right in those early sobriety days, was that I did keep 1 foot in a 12-step program. I would go to meetings somewhat regularly, even though I wasn't really working a program. So I saw people who had the solution, and I was convinced that it could work, you know, in a way that kind of before I might have just brushed it off.
I think it's also really important to note that like it doesn't look perfect. And it's okay if it doesn't look perfect at first, as long as you don't pick up that drink. Like, like it sounds annoying to hear, like, no matter what, don't pick up. But it's true. It's like, true. No matter what happens, like, do not pick up. Like, don't pick up a drink. Don't pick up a drug. Like, eat that whole pizza if you have to.
Yeah.
You know, which is not healthy either.
Right. Right.
But at the same time, it's like, especially these days with fentanyl and who knows what else, like, don't pick up. Just don't pick up.
Right. Yeah. So I.
So you did that right.
I did that part right. Truly. Like, I had gotten to that point of surrender where I knew that it wouldn't work, you know, like I had tried that before. I had done the 2.5 months. And I remember after those 2.5 months sober, when I then picked up again, thinking like, tomorrow morning, I'll tell my sponsor, I'll reset my clock, it'll be fine. I just want to I just want to see if it feels different. And then I didn't, you know, take a sober breath for 2 weeks. Like, I did not call my sponsor the next morning. I finished the other half of the handle that I started the night before.
But this time you decided.
And so this time I was, and so this, you know, now after having gone to my, you know, what, fifth rehab, I was like, all right, I've tried that before. Like, it didn't work. Like, if I pick up a drink now, I believed, like, in my core that it would be the same as trying to kill myself again. Like, that those things were starting to become just intertwined. And so that fear, I guess, kind of kept me from the drink in that moment. And the other thing I did right in early recovery was that I stayed with a consistent therapist and someone that I trusted. And so I didn't have a sponsor, I had her. And so she recommended somebody for me to call and talk to. And I called them. And when I first called my sponsor, who's still my sponsor today, I remember talking with her on the phone and her being like, well, I've got a lot going on. I've got a few sponsees. Like, I don't know if I can really sponsor you, but like, what's going on? You know, if your therapist told me to call you, I'm sure there was a good reason for it. And, so I told her what was going on and she goes, oh, I'll be your sponsor. And so she's been my sponsor since. And,
oh, good.
She's been fantastic and taken me through the steps. And as she would say, like, you know, put my hand in God's hand, and I will forever be grateful to her for that. So it's been so much better since I've done that. And I was resistant to the process. Like, even after being like, all right, like, I am at my spiritual bottom. I don't know what else I could do. Like, I've been sober over a year and I'm fucking miserable. Like, like, I remember someone used to say, like, man, that person's, like, they're so miserable, they may as well just drink. Like, why are you doing this? You know, like, I was getting to that point. And
I'll never forget, before I checked myself sober into that, I was so miserable. I'm like, this might as well
be like, drinking. I didn't get sober
people
to be miserable.
Like, yeah,
you
but
know?
You didn't pick up. I'm like, but it felt just as bad.
Yeah.
You know, it did. That mental sickness, that obsession, like, feels just as bad.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that didn't, you know, kind of sort of kicking and screaming, I worked the steps against my will. Yeah, honestly, to the point where, like, I made my sponsor sit and, like, argued with her for an hour before my fifth step.
Do I know your sponsor?
You do.
Okay.
Yeah, you know her.
She loves you.
Yeah.
Because I love my most difficult sponsees, and I'm sure you love your most difficult sponsees, because in the end, like,
you see them
the
get sober, right? Like, yeah, that's what's, like, so cool so about cool. it. And like I said, she's still my sponsor now 2 years later. So,
of course. And it's so cool. It's so cool to see people transform, and that fight is, like, imperative. I think we all have to have it.
Yeah.
It's part of the process. So, so tell me what it looks like now.
Yeah. So now, after giving my sponsor the hardest time on my four step, like, things started to get better, and that, like, in spite of myself, you know, like, I didn't believe it would work. I did it just because I like, fine, I'll try it. Like, nothing else is working.
Yeah.
And I started feeling happier and more connected. And, at the time, I was working as a sustainability engineer, which was something I had wanted to get into. Like, I now work as a renewable energy developer. And
I would love to know what that means, but let's talk about that after this. Sure.
Yes. Happy to tell you more. But yeah, so I was working as a sustainability engineer, wasn't loving it. But was in a position where my life was starting to get more full, and I had better relationships with the people, you know, my family and friends. And I started to have friends, you know, before that it was the boyfriend and then kind of like whatever fit into the circle around that, but that was all there really was. And
that's not where it's
at. And that's not where it's at. Right. And so I started to build better connections and better relationships with other women in my life, and prioritize people that, you know, were worth prioritizing, and being more conscious of that, and trying to be a better person and better friend. And as I, you know, continued through, a job opportunity came up, and like, you know, my career is important to me, and it's something that I'm passionate about, and I love being independent and being able to take care of myself. And I also, you know, I like liking what I do every day, you know, and I like working with great people and getting to experience new things through my job. And I wound up finding a role at, of all the places, actually the company that I wanted to work for back when I went to Harvard Business School. So I wound up now, the job I'm in is the job that I had wanted to do back before all of this happened. And so like the whole idea of like, you know, the universe has a plan and like you wind up where you're supposed to be, like the whole, the plan in my mind was go to business school, graduate, get the job, you know, do all the things like in the right order. And like, God had a different plan than that. Like I was supposed to learn some things that I couldn't learn in the classroom at business school. You know, like I kind of joke, you know, we were talking about going back to business school, and like, I learned everything I needed to learn in my second year of business school in rehab.
Right.
like all of those things, like I went there to change my life. I went there because I had this empty hole in my soul that I didn't know how to fill. Yeah. And I was trying to fill with all these wrong things.
You got what you needed.
And ultimately, like, talk about like this roller coaster that you can't predict. Like I got what I wanted out of that, just in this whole roundabout crazy backwards way.
Yeah. I mean, isn't it funny?
Turned out the way it was supposed to. And now, like, I just got back from a trip to Peru where I went by myself.
I lived there for 2 years.
The Inca Trail. Did you? Yes. Oh, I should have hit you up before for recommendations.
Oh my God. Did you climb Huayna Picchu?
I did. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll talk after.
I hiked the Inca Trail. And so, like, you know, I travel alone. Like, I couldn't have been in an airport for more than 5 minutes without getting drunk before. Like, so the idea of traveling by myself and like having the confidence and like it's fun. Like now I'm kind of like, people ask me if I want to do travel with them, and I'm like, do I have to?
Right. Because you never, I know. No, traveling with people can be not a good thing. I did
it. So I have to check myself
last February. And I was like, oh my God, work called me. I got to do work now. You know, it was just the worst trip ever.
Was it? Oh, gosh, that's so hard.
But it was a good lesson.
Yeah.
Careful who you travel with.
True.
Well, I'm so grateful, and I'm really appreciative that you came today and that you battled with me through the dog interruptions and everything. And
hopefully it comes out okay.
It will come out okay, and it'll come out how it's supposed to.
There you go. Exactly.
And we may have to call you back. Who knows?
And that would be fine too.
But thank you so much. And I have one question I ask everyone. So if you could go back and tell your younger self, you choose the age. Yeah. what would you say? And what age? What age, what would you say?
Oh man. The first like phrase that popped into my head when you said that, so I'll just go with the first thing, was take it easy.
And what age do you picture yourself like when you say
16.
That? 16. Okay, okay.
Like when I was 16, 17, and like worrying about being like the perfect grown-up human and like doing all the things and checking all the boxes and doing everything right. like, could you could have taken it a little easier on yourself.
Yeah.
Like, put down the bat. Like, you don't have to be so hard.
Like, put down the bat. I like that.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you so much for coming. I hope you enjoyed it.
I did. I did. Yeah, this has been a great experience. Thanks so much for having me.
Yay, good. Okay, let's hug. Yeah.